Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're pleased to have David Aronovich on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. When I was a young lad growing up in the center of the United States, I saw a television program called The Chariots of the Gods by Eric von Däniken. It made quite an impression on me because it demonstrated to my satisfaction that, in fact, the Earth had been visited eons ago by aliens. And these aliens had brought the technology with which humans first built civilization. The pyramids were built by aliens, it turns out, as Mr. von Däniken demonstrated. I only much later learned that all of this was kind of elaborate fiction. And I have to say I was really quite disappointed that it was, because I felt like I knew something that other people didn't. And I think it is ever such with conspiracy theories, where we want to believe these things. And David Aronovich has provided a really interesting history of them and catalog of them for us to think about. They are, of course, all false. They range from the protocols of the Elders of Zion to the recent allegations or theories that 9/11 was cooked up somehow by Skull and Bones or the Illuminati or George Bush and Dick Cheney or something like this. I don't know. The worldwide Jewish conspiracy. David does a good job of both debunking all of these theories and explaining why we hold on to them so fiercely and how dangerous they can be. I enjoyed talking to David today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, David.
Hello, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm really good. I'm sitting in a hotel room in New York City, and it's a nice morning here. I've been running in Central Park, and I feel great.
I used to run in Central Park. It's a great place to run.
It sure is. It's almost exactly 6 miles round, which is what the Japanese writer Murakami recommends as
is
your daily
that
dose.
Right. I used to run around what's called the reservoir. Anyway, I should tell our listeners that we have David Aronovich on the show today, and we'll be talking about his book, Voodoo Histories. Hold on, I have to grab it here to get the subtitle. Sorry to say. Unprepared. The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Pardon me for that. I, as you know, if you listen to the show, and I'm sure you do, I read these books. Not to imply that other interviewers don't, but I do read them, and I read this
one. Perish the thought.
Yeah. But I can tell you, this one is really good, and it's extraordinarily well written in the sense that it's, I would call the style serious, but a little bit arch. And there's some very funny things that you say in it, even though the topic is deadly, literally deadly serious. And that's a tough trick, actually. I mean, I think most professional historians, and I know a lot of professional historians listen to this show, is we tend to be super serious about things and, never a light thought. But this book is full of quite wonderful turns of phrases and light thoughts, which David will prevent you from ever getting a career in an academic history department. I'm sure you're just absolutely incredibly disappointed.
Yeah, you just lost me that professorship at Harvard.
That's right. Yes, the Ballywood professorship at Oxford is not yours and never shall be. But you ain't missing much, as we say here in the Midwest. But let me ask you to begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and your communist past. Oh wait, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No.
Yeah, well, I'm a journalist in England. I write for the London Times. I've also worked for the BBC in my time. By background, I'm a Londoner. My parents were both members of the British Communist Party. That gives me a sort of rather unusual background. In fact, my father worked full-time for the British Communist Party until I was 13. And he was a Jewish guy out of the East End of London, which is kind of like, you know, where Jews came in the big exodus from Russia at about the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. And my mother was an English woman whose father was in the British Army. So it's sort of an unusual background, and I grew up and was brought up in North London, and have been a serious journalist. I mean, you know, really serious, with a serious look on my face, for the best part of 30 years now. God, can it really be 30 yeah. years? Anyway,
30 I don't like to think now. About those things. I wanted to ask, does I'm working full time for the Communist Party. Do you get health benefits with that or a pension? Or?
Well, of course, we in Britain have the National Health
yes,
Service.
Yes, that's right.
So
yeah.
Everybody, even communists could get health service without actually having to pay up front.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And so why don't you tell us how you came to write this book?
Well, I think partially for the reasons I've just been talking about, I've always been interested in the question of why people chose to believe what they believe. I mean, obviously, you know, if you look at my parents, and in fact, when we come later to talk about my next project, that's where it's heading. One of the things that I had to explain was why they could believe some of the positive things they believed and choose not to believe other things which were kind of lying in front of them in plain view. And that's always given me an interest in why people choose to believe what they do and whether or not we can kind of construct what I would call a kind of real skepticism, I mean a genuine intellectual openness towards events and make up our own minds, or whether we're continuously victims, if you like, of our own desires to believe stuff in order to make ourselves feel better. And so I got interested in conspiracy theories. I mean, partially the conspiracy theories in particular, what spurred the book in particular, was going to Tunisia for the BBC in 2002 with a great guy who was a cameraman, and we were doing quite a difficult assignment because it was about Tunisian treatment of dissidents and political prisoners and so on, and we were having to do it undercover. So this was a very intelligent guy. Anyway, we were driving down from the capital city, Tunis, to a place called El Jem, where there's an amphitheater where actually part of Gladiator was filmed. And it was a long journey, and he turned to me while we were driving down. He said, David, you know the moon landing of 1969? I said, sure I do. I saw it on TV when I was a kid. And he said, you didn't, you know. what do you mean I didn't? He said, well, it didn't happen. It was all done in a film studio, probably in California. And then he went on about, you know, these what he thought were killer facts about the stars not being visible in the photographs, or the flag on the moon was waving, but of course there's no gravity on the moon, so that was impossible. Mm-hmm. And he took these to mean that no such landing happened. And he looked round at me in that way that kind of conspiracy theory people do, with that kind of glint in the eye, you know, like kind of gotcha.
Yeah.
And he said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, my immediate feeling is that it would actually be harder to organize a hoaxed moon landing than the real one. Because kind of for a real one, all you'd need is rockets and NASA and all the stuff that we know that there is there. Whereas for a hoaxed moon landing, you'd have to get 20,000 people to keep quiet about something, to lie about something, for the entirety of the rest of their lives. I thought, I just can't see it. And I also said to him, you know, also, I saw a movie about this, which you may not have seen, because he's a bit younger than me, called Capricorn One, which exactly this happens. I mean, did you see that movie?
I've seen it. I watched it pretty recently.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what that says about me, but I did.
Yeah. Well, it's a fun movie. Of course it is. I mean, you know, for those who don't confuse movies with real life, it is a fun movie.
Yeah.
They're going to go on a trip to Mars. The guys are up there in the capsule. The countdown has begun, you know, 10, 9. And then at the last second, if you remember, they're taken out of the capsule by sort of strange kind of guys. They're put into a studio and they're forced to kind of act this stuff out. And you remember what happens? What happens is that they decide that they can't possibly live with telling this lie to their families for the rest of their lives. And they decide to escape. So they escape across the Mojave Desert and they're pursued by helicopters. You know what I like most about this?
Yeah.
I like most about this, the fact that one of them was played by O.J. Simpson.
That's true. And he has almost no lines in it. He almost says nothing. It's really interesting. He says nothing in the film. Yeah.
So that really got me, that whole incident got me going. And I went back and I thought, why does somebody like this guy, Kevin, really want to believe this? And what other examples are there? And I was always already aware of a number. And right about that time, too, there was the beginning of what you call the 9/11 truth movement. It was the first beginnings of people saying, hey, that object that hit the Pentagon, it wasn't a plane, it was a missile. And I thought, it's really interesting. There are intelligent people here signing up for for this really absurd idea and pushing it for everything. And in fact, they believe in it. A religion, as if they were political, really political activists. They're giving it that much effort. What's going on here? So that's how I came.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a terrific topic for a book, and I commend you on it. It's a real public service to have written this book. Let me say that. I usually don't get kind of treacly about these things, but I hope that many, many people read this book because this is a reflex of I don't think it's just modern times, but it's certainly at least of modern times, to believe in things which are impossible. I think it probably has something to do with the fact that we live in a kind of desacralized world, to use a what my mom would call a 50-cent word. We live in a world that God has a kind of tenuous existence in. And so we have to believe in something a little bit outrageous. And if it's not the Loch Ness Monster, then it's that, Skull and Bones is behind 9/11 or something like that. I don't know what it would be. It is quite a remarkable thing. And I think, I think that you point out many, many good things about conspiracies, many interesting things about conspiracy theories in the book, and we'll talk about them in the course of time. But I want to begin by just talking about some of them, because some of the listeners, I'm sure many of the listeners, won't be well aware of all of them that you cover. But I wanted to start with what is, I think I'm almost certainly the most harmful of all conspiracy theories of all time, at least measured in human life, and that is the notion that somehow the Jews are behind everything. I have a Jewish friend that says, "Yeah, the Jews behind everything, if only." So yeah, the protocols of the elders of Zion. Could you tell us the story of that?
Yeah, I can. I mean, and it gives you an illustrated point. I mean, the way in which this thing moves on. There are some people now who would argue that the Jews were even behind the Holocaust. You know, that it was Zionist leaders got together with the Germans in some way in order to create the Holocaust because that would help them to bring Israel about. So you can even get to be that lunatic. And the protocols of the Elders of Zion essentially was a pamphlet. If you think about the kind of version of the nearest thing to the version of the internet you would have had in 1919, which would have been fairly cheaply produced pamphlets on what are much more efficient printing presses, easily and quickly translated, being produced simultaneously in many different countries. Henry Ford was responsible for producing hundreds of thousands of them in America. And essentially, this pamphlet, the Protocols of the Elders, has the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is usually part of this pamphlet. The pamphlet is often called something like the International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem, something like that. It will have the protocols in the middle of it. And what this purports to be is a record of a meeting of kind of top Jews, sort of the meeting, you know, if you look at the kind of board of Jews Inc.
Yeah.
That's right, in the 1890s. And what they've kind of planned to do is they plan to take over kind of everything. They're going to get hold of all the political parties, and they're going to get hold of all the newspapers, and they're going to get hold of all the kind of finance houses and the trades unions and so on. And the whole object is, incidentally, they're going to unleash a tide of filth and pornography as well, just for kind of good measure, which I kind of, if I was them, that would be the job I'd most like. And they're going to do this in order to kind of bring about a series of ructions and disputes and then revolutions and then war. And at the end of it, there'll be chaos. And then in that chaos, humanity will look around for somebody to rule them, and who will be there but the Jews, and everybody will become Jews, and so on. Now, of course, we would regard kind of believing in such a thing here in for most of us in the West now as being utterly and completely ludicrous. But it obviously wasn't so ludicrous to our great-grandparents who bought into this theory in significant numbers. I mean, I work for the Times of London. In 1920, there's an editorial in the Times of London saying, if this document is a forgery, then, and I quote, whence comes the uncanny note of prophecy? In other words, it all sounds a bit true to us. And they're calling for an inquiry into this stuff. Can you believe it? Wanting an inquiry into whether there's been a kind of global Jewish conspiracy to run the world. Anyway, next year, the London Times correspondent Constantinople, is given a book by a Russian exile, and this book is a satire which was published in Belgium in the 1860s, and about two-fifths of it is exactly the same as what's in the protocols, except just with everything changed. In other words, somebody had taken this book and then just changed all the kind of words to Jews and then printed it just after the war. But the point you were making was millions of people believed in this, and in Germany at any rate, it became a staple text of the Nazis. Senior Nazis, before they took power, had their own copies of the protocols and believed in it fundamentally, as did Hitler. Hitler believed in the underlying truth of it, and obviously it becomes a big argument that leads up to the Holocaust. But let me give you another small example, because it seems to me interesting. You know that the Nazis took over half of France, but there was half of France they didn't take over. We call that Vichy France. Mm-hmm. It ruled from Vichy underneath a soldier called Marshal Pétain. Essentially, it was collaborating with the Nazis, but it was formally independent. The Vichy's commissioner for Jewish affairs was a guy called Charles Darquet de Pellepoix. Actually, his real name was just Darquet, and he added the de Pellepoix himself. Now, this guy was an absolute loser. He was kind of what they call a boulevardier. He was a ne'er-do-well. There's a brilliant book about him by somebody called Carmen Khalil, which goes into his life. And he didn't really believe in anything except one thing. He had read a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and he believed it to be true. He became Vichy France's commissioner for Jewish affairs, and in that role, organized the deportation of French Jews to Auschwitz. Yeah. In other words, there is a direct read-off, in his case, between the protocols, the actions he took, and the deaths of thousands of people.
I mean, I think it's important to say that, you know, in the genesis of these things, how they take off, I mean, they seem completely loopy to us. But that's kind of a dangerous thought, because, as you say, a lot of what we would call right-thinking people suspected that that these things might be true. And I think it's important to kind of put it in a broader context of what they thought that they knew. They knew that Jews were meeting in the late 19th century to form something. And in one case, it was a kind of a communist party. That's the Jewish Bund. But in the case that they all remember, it's, of course, Israel. That's the Zionist movement. So there were meetings going on, right? I mean, there really were Jews meeting to do this. These people were, at least in some cases, appeared to be kind of foreign. The case of many of the very assimilated Jews, as in the United States and England, you can't really, you know, they're totally assimilated, so you can't tell. But in other places, they were not, and they have this peculiar practice of endogamy. They marry largely, not completely, of course, but within their own group, and this seemed kind of strange. And they practice this weird religion with these weird characters, and they killed Christ, and supposedly, and these other things. Kind of all, it all fits, and then, of course, there's this occupational business. You know, that Jews sort of gravitated towards certain kinds of professions. Of course, they didn't have any choice but to gravitate towards certain kinds of professions because they weren't allowed in other ones. But and so, you know, it what a conspiracy theorist says about this stuff is it all the word the metaphor they love is fits. But of course, when you look at it, none of it fits really. But they seem to need to make it fit so that they draw these facts together. And then you kind of what I think is that, at least in this case, not in all the cases of conspiracy theory, is the scapegoating that goes on. That's really the thing that drives it. It's not my fault. It's somebody else's fault. Things are going downhill. Exactly. It's not my fault. It's their fault. And this kind of projection.
Go ahead.
No, if you're at the end of the First World War and you're looking around for why it is that every crowned head in Europe, just about, and it's certainly all those who exercise absolute power, have fallen. You know, the Sultan is just about to fall. The Tsar has gone in the revolution. The Kaiser is gone. The Emperor of Austria-Hungary, together with his whole empire, has gone. And these people are looking around for an explanation. Now, of course, they may have been the same people who crowded into the squares in Vienna. In the case of Hitler, there's actually a picture which shows him doing it to say, yeah, war, right. You know, we're going to win this. Our troops will be home by Christmas. When they lose the war and it's cataclysmic, they turn around in 1919 and say, well, you know, it was the Jews. It wasn't us. Yeah. You know, so there's a kind of avoiding of their own responsibility there. And I think, as you say, the Jews were a kind of useful scapegoat because they had all these facets that you said. They had this sort of writing in Hebrew, which non-Jews didn't understand. They both seemed to be part of and not quite part of society, which was kind of an interesting place for them to be. So they became quite easily identified as a group. And finally, they were international, because in that period there was no Israel, there was no kind of Jewish country, and so on. Mm-hmm. So Jews were seen as what they called the word cosmopolitan.
Yep.
They were actually in Stalin's anti-Semitic and Eastern European anti-Semitic purges in the late 40s and 50s, the word cosmopolitan, in other words, rootless, not having a nationality, yeah, and so on, was actually specifically used as a term to mean Jew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's
exactly. So I absolutely buy the reasons why, in a sense, the Jews got it. But over and above that was the kind of notion, please show us the real underlying planned cause of this catastrophe, mm-hmm, which has happened to us.
Yeah, everything happened. Yeah,
and I think that's the real kind of motivation. Don't try and tell us that it was a combination of our fault, our hubris, our miscalculation, you know, gradual periods of absurd rearmament and belligerence over the years. Rather tell us that somebody planned the whole thing secretly, and that will give us the keys to the entire business.
Yeah, in my case, that role is played by my mother-in-law. But I don't. she's plotting my downfall.
She's a fan of the show.
Yeah, no, I don't think she listens. Thank God. No, I'm kidding. Of course, Maria, I'm kidding. Right now. It's a joke. But you know, this the thing about these, you know, these things can be debunked and debunked and debunked. But if the underlying reasons to believe in them, that is the kind of scapegoating and the notion that things somehow fit, if they continue, then they still have life. And as you point out in your book, and I've read this before, but it's so shocking that I always forget it. Do you have any facts like that that you're just like, I can hardly believe this is true? But
yeah,
if you go look at you look at textbooks.
There's a guy who's started emailing me this morning, seeming reasonable, with stuff that is so ridiculous. I mean, he's decided that no Jews were killed forces in the Second World War,
yeah,
and that Jews get everybody else to die, so on. Yeah. And he's kind of got this thing that he says is research. And I know perfectly well that if I start Googling it, it will turn out to be a website on a neo-Nazi site and so on. But I look at this and think, oh, come on, you know.
Yeah. But anyway, the fact that I was going to say is in your book is that if you go to the Palestinian an authority today and you look at the textbooks that children read, or you look in the declaration of, or the, I forget exactly what it's called, the principles of the of Hamas.
Yeah, the covenant.
The covenant of Hamas.
Yeah.
You find the things like the protocol or the protocol mentioned.
It's in the Hamas covenant. And that's serious enough, but sometimes this even takes laughable forms. If you look, if you look at Iranian TV, there'll regularly be features in which an Iranian professor of media studies from Tehran University will come in and analyse Hollywood movies. And one from a couple of years ago was Meet the Fockers, and Meet the Fockers they analysed as an attempt to gain sympathy for Israel and the Jews in the Ben Stiller character. And then this guy said, you know, and as you know, they did do this as laid down by the protocols of the Elders of Zion. In other words, whoever did Meet the Fockers is carrying out his kind of, you know, historic conspiratorial role.
Ben Stiller can't even win sympathy for Ben Stiller. I mean, the guy gets no love at all anywhere. So he wouldn't be my spokesman.
In that case, the conspiracy is just going to have to get rid of him and find somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen.
Well, although certainly part of the conspiracy.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm laughing about these things, but you know they're really not funny, and they really are not, because these deep-seated prejudices have brought us just untold woe in the 20th century. And this business with Jews is just – I don't know. I just hope it ends. I don't want to – it's just so – it's one of these things – you know, there are a few issues that I was born with and I think I'll die with, and this is one of them. I'm just – you can read this stuff in the paper every day all my life, and I'm tired of it now. I don't want to deal with it anymore. So let's move on to one which was a bit more evanescent and had less persistence. And you move rather quickly to a context which I didn't expect, and that is the Soviet Union in the 1930s, and something that many of the listeners will know about, many of them I think won't, and that is the purge trials. Why don't you talk a little about those?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to look at was what you might call official conspiracy theories. In other words, conspiracy theories which governments believe and which governments circulate. And I think one of the biggest was the idea that in the 30s in Stalinist Russia, that there was a gigantic gigantic conspiracy involving Trotskyists, oppositionists, to subvert and bring down Russia in the 30s. And it was the basis of the big Moscow show trials. There were three major ones involving about 35, 40 key figures, which also gave rise to thousands and thousands and thousands of smaller local trials, and sometimes no trials at all, in which people, for the most part, were sent to the gulags, but in significant numbers of cases were simply shot. And there's no doubt that there was a kind of hysteria. It's not totally unlike witch hunting hysteria, in which people denounced each other, became convinced that each other were parts of this conspiracy. They became convinced that these oppositionists were not just people who didn't agree with Stalin, but they were also conscious agents of Japan and of France and of Britain and of Nazi Germany and so on. And there was faked evidence, and there were confessions got out by duress and torture and so on. And there was a significant proportion of people on the left watching these trials who thought, yeah, they're true. These people are obviously telling the truth when they're giving you all these confessions. There was this sort of gigantic conspiracy. Now, one of the things that I find interesting about this is that during the 30s, the Soviet Union was undergoing its incredibly rapid industrialization. And the industrialization was proceeding at a pace which far exceeded the capacity to produce skilled engineers and operators to run it. And what was the result of that? One of the results of that was a huge number of industrial accidents, breakdowns of machinery, and so on. And one of the things that happens in the Moscow trials and the Great Conspiracy is the idea that these things are not caused by accident, but they're all caused by the Trotskyist acts of sabotage. You know, and when I was a kid, there were still jokes about how Trotskyists put glass in the workers' butter. You know, there was still kind of this notion that Trotskyists would be responsible for these acts of sabotage, which in fact were ways of giving human agency to the fact that the industrialization had proceeded at a pace that actually the education system of Russia at the time couldn't sustain.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, there was the fact that having an enemy like this was very convenient for Stalin and his buddies. He wanted an enemy such as this within so that he could use extreme measures to get rid of people who had, in fact, been in the opposition in the 1920s. They were no longer in the opposition, and they were completely, you know, isn't to say they agreed with Stalin, but they certainly weren't German agents as they were portrayed. And so Stalin and his buddies cooked up really pretty elaborate stories, didn't they? And then sort of told people about them.
They did. But one of the things that I sort of trying to get a handle on, it's really difficult, is to what degree Stalin and his buddies actually believed that a lot of this was true. In other words, convinced themselves, they kind of constructed, if you like, a fantasy within which their fears were kind of confirmed. What they thought they were discovering were confirmed by things that they had effectively created themselves. And I'm pretty sure that it's certainly true of the show trials in Eastern Europe in the late 40s, early 50s. There was a significant amount of belief by the people organizing this stuff themselves that actually they were true, that these oppositionists had somehow or other moved from being what you might call subjective enemies, in other words, they disagreed with Stalin, to being objective enemies, in other words, they'd taken their disagreement and made it concrete by through actual acts of sabotage and spying, and so on. And so I lean to the idea that Stalin, and certainly those around him, have become convinced themselves that there were these plots. And as I said to you right at the beginning, it's fascinating to me how people choose to and get to believe what they do. And nothing now would astonish me about what people can convince themselves will be true. It's a bit like believing that the entire weather is the result of some kind of conspiracy. People will believe all sorts of strange things about where they picked up illnesses and so on without any kind of evidence. They will believe amazing things about complementary therapies without any kind of good reason. And I think the same is true on the political front sometimes.
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. In the case of Stalin particularly, I think there's a fair amount of evidence, better than a fair amount of evidence, that he did actually believe all of these things. He came from a world of conspiracies, actual conspiracies, because he was a member of one. And so he knew how they operated. He had grown up in one. And all of the old Bolsheviks had. So they were very aware of this kind of thing. And then there are other things that he did which suggest that he did believe that there were, you know, the anti-Semitism after World War II, which was completely senseless and, you know, it really makes no sense at all. Even politically, Stalin was then, you know, he had nothing to gain by this weird sort of anti-Semitic campaign. But he did it anyway.
Yeah, and, he kind of thought the Jews
liked. Yeah, he thought that the Jews were somehow going to subvert the Soviet. I don't know what he thought. Again, it's one of these things that is just really very hard to wrap your mind around.
He thought they had a secret somehow that he wasn't in on.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence that he believed that. And, you know, we know that Hitler believed that there really was a Jewish conspiracy. I don't think there's any question about this. I think it's a great mistake when thinking about North Korea, for example, to think that, you know, Kim Jong-il is in fact leading two lives. One is the very cynical front that he puts up, and the other is him, you know, what he really believes. And he's really kind of just like us.
Exactly.
But I don't think he is just like us. I think he really does believe everything he says.
Yeah.
Now that puts him in a different world than us, and makes him more dangerous, I think. And similarly with Osama bin Laden and these guys. I mean, they're, you know, they aren't cynics. That's the hard thing to accept about it. They're not cynical. They were, but they're not cynics. They're believers. And that's a frightening thought, and it comes out quite clearly in the book. Let's move on to another case, one that I actually learned a lot about, and I had no idea that there was a connection here between the people who were sort of suspicious about World War I and World War II and America's involvement in World War I and World War II, and then later the Red Scare. And you talk particularly about a guy that I'd never even heard of. I'm not an American historian, so it doesn't surprise me. A guy named Flynn, I think was his name? John Flynn?
John Flynn, who was what we call a muckraking journalist.
Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about him?
Muckraking doesn't really have the kind of connotation it has now. Muckraking meant guys who were prepared to rake through the muck in order to find the truth.
Now we call them reporters, don't we? Isn't that what
investigative reporters? We would call them. You know, you have some major examples of people like that who also became novelists and so on.
Yeah.
Who looked through the American meat industry and the conditions of American workers and so on, and they played a very substantial role. But it's absolutely right. There's a kind of – it's the link, if you like, that, sometimes tenuous, sometimes more precise. And it's not a conspiratorial link. It's an ideological link. It's a link of ideas being taken up from one generation to another between, if you like, American populism of the kind of prairie version of the 1900s. And it's sort of – you know, it's occasional incarnation as a prejudice against foreigners, but also it's anti-elite kind of notion. You know, the notion that particularly Midwestern farmers and other people like that had, that there was a kind of national elite who were always out to do them down, and that this elite was in bed with big finance.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, big finance, of course, later on becomes mean Jews. Sometimes does and it sometimes doesn't. But there's a kind of link between that and after the First World War, after Wilson had taken America into the First World War, and America had lost several hundred thousand lives in the business of helping sort out the European continent for it, there was a huge reaction in America against this, enormous reaction. And the whole 30s show, and 20s and 30s show, an enormous swing towards isolationism. America wouldn't join the very League of Nations that it itself had helped set up. The American armed forces were reduced once again to a kind of minimum in order not to get involved in foreign entanglements and so on. At the same time, there was the Roosevelt in the wake of the Depression. There was obviously Roosevelt and the New Deal. And so you had these kind of ideas wandering around. There's a lot of people who initially supported Roosevelt, who became very suspicious of what he did in the New Deal, felt that it was an example of the big state trying to run everybody's lives, thought actually that it looked a bit like fascism on the continent. It looked a bit like what people like Mussolini and so on was doing. And John Flynn, who was a muckraking journalist, was one of these who'd started off as a Roosevelt supporter and gradually became more and more critical of Roosevelt. And towards the end of the 30s, these same group of people became very suspicious that as Europe marched steadily towards war, that Roosevelt would try and embroil America in the European war. And their fear, quite overtly, was that an America that was drawn into the war would itself effectively become a dictatorship, because the government would be able to take powers during the war that it would never otherwise have. And they began to suggest that, in their own minds, that Roosevelt was doing this on purpose. Now, of course, what Roosevelt saw was that that America could not afford to allow Nazi Germany to win complete power in Europe and destroy the democracies of France and Britain. But it was a hard job persuading the American people after the First World War this was going to be the case. Mm-hmm. So you have this enormous movement in America of America First isolationism. It's incredibly difficult, even after the beginning of the Second World War, to get concrete support for the democracies against the Nazis. It only just managed, against huge opposition, to get Lend-Lease. You remember the business whereby America effectively lends a whole series of old and mothballed destroyers and other equipment to Great Britain in return, theoretically, for repayments much later. Huge opposition to that. Very interesting people who are members of America First at this stage, the young Jack Kennedy, the young Gore Vidal, who has never seen a conspiracy theory yet that he didn't believe.
That guy.
One of America's great wits and raconteurs and so on, is a serial conspiracy theorist, but very, very opposed to Roosevelt and the Second World War. And so anyway, America First is incredibly powerful, huge meetings, Charles Lindbergh and so on as its figurehead. And then what happens? 7th of December 1941, the date that will live in infamy, the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor. And America First is destroyed as a movement because there is no popular support for it any longer. A few days after Pearl Harbor, the Germans declare war on America, and America is in fact involved in the war. And for 4 years after that, 3 or 4 years, the anti-war people try to work out what happened to them. And by the end of the war, they're coming up with a version. And the version essentially says, we were tricked into war. We were tricked into war by communists, partially, because they wanted to come into the war on the side of Stalin, and because they ran Hollywood, and because and this was among some people, and because they were a bit Jewish as well, I'd run it. And we'd also been brought into war because Roosevelt had allowed the attack on Pearl Harbor to happen, knowing that it was going to happen. Now, the same sort of people who believed this sort of thing became very, very supportive, many of them, of McCarthy and the McCarthy-era notion, the notion that there had been running American foreign affairs in the period before the war, a group of people kind of secretly, and the communists in this case, who had melded American foreign policy in the objectives of communism. And so you can see how that then begins to link into, ideas terms, to McCarthyism. And it also becomes the idea, gradually mutates into the idea, that not only did Roosevelt provoke the Japanese into attack, but he actually knew, because America had broken the codes, which incidentally it hadn't in the way they say, but anyway, and actually knew an attack on Pearl Harbor was coming, but permitted it in order to get his war.
It's a fascinating story, and the book does a wonderful job of laying it out. I don't know, I've done a lot of these interviews now, and although I'm not an American historian, I have to say that one of the conclusions I've reached about American history is that Woodrow Wilson was the worst president of the 20th century. That guy was a disaster in so many ways, because the movement was started after we got involved in World War One, and should we have or not, I don't really know. I think it's also important to give the firsters kind of their due. It wasn't completely obvious in 1938, 1939 that Germany would be as militarily powerful as it turned out to be. I mean, when they knocked out Poland, people thought, well, okay, that's Poland. When they knocked out France, then it was pretty clear that know, that was a different story. And then it became more difficult, I think, to say that the Germans couldn't seriously contend for a kind of all-European dominance. But so there was a time in the 30s in which it wasn't, I think, illogical to say, look, we don't want to be involved, that we, being the United States, don't want to be involved in this. But also another thing I wanted to say is
that I'll just say this, however, looked at from the other side of the Atlantic.
Oh, yeah.
Looked at from the other side of the Atlantic, it feels kind of very different.
Yeah.
There the threat was kind of imminent, and the need to have America as an ally democracy is overwhelming. So you're absolutely right. It's important for me as a Brit to kind of keep a kind of sense of what it might have looked like to the average of American, and that's perfectly true.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Another thing I wanted to say is that, you know, I think a lot of people overseas have a sense of this as well, that somehow these isolationist movements and this kind of, I'm trying to think of the right word for it, kind of anti-elitism comes from the American Midwest. I'm from the Midwest. I was born here and I teach here now. And although I've spent actually most of my life on the East and West Coast and overseas in Europe, but it's true that there is a kind of resentment in the Midwest. If you listen to, as I sometimes do, much to my wife's chagrin, what we call country music, you'll find that there's a lot of there's a lot of kind of bitterness and resentment toward what people would think of as East Coast elites. Even though those East Coast elites often turn out to be Midwesterners, people like Herbert Hoover, who's from Iowa, and Harry Truman, who's from Missouri, and Lyndon Johnson, who's from Texas. And Bill Clinton, who's from Arkansas. So it's somewhat illogical, but I think people in the Midwest, you know, they feel like they've gotten somehow short shrift, and there are people, you know, East Coast establishment is somehow running things, and we're suspicious of that. Having moved with the East Coast establishment a little bit earlier in my life, I can assure you that they aren't running things, really. And they really – they don't run anything very well that they run. So we shouldn't worry about it too much. Anyway, I wanted to go on to what is the mother of all conspiracy theories for Americans, and that is the supposed plot to assassinate JFK. I even interviewed a fellow, a very smart fellow, professional historian, who has written a book saying that, you know, the question is still open. And he's a very smart guy, good credentials, great researcher, very eloquent. And he says, you know, it really is an open question as to whether there wasn't a conspiracy involved in this. But maybe you just tell the stories about how the idea that there was a conspiracy popped up, and it did immediately, right?
Oh, yeah. It was really very quick. And, I mean, the first thing to say is that most of my adult life I believed it was a conspiracy, not because I did any research, but because everybody around me believed that. I mean, you remember the kind of Woody Allen joke that he was hard at work on a non-fiction version of the Warren Commission.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that joke can only work if everybody kind of understands what you're talking about and where you're coming from, and we all did. And I certainly believed that for most of my adult life, actually, until I really got into the business of writing this book. It's important to realize that immediately after the assassination itself, there were a couple of reactions. One reaction was a sense of absolute horror that such a thing could happen in America. I mean, a really huge cry from a large number of American intellectuals and others that said, how have we become the kind of country where people like Lee Harvey Oswald are wandering around wanting to kill people and wanting to kill our leaders? How is this possible? It's really, really, really terrible. And parallel with that, growing up alongside it is the idea, essentially, well, actually, we're not that kind of people. The real truth is, they did it. They organized it. It wasn't a single guy, as it had been in all these other cases of American assassinations. It was really something much more controlled and much more organized. You know, and that movement started almost the moment that Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but and you say this in the book, but we should put it in perspective. Americans kill their presidents all the time. It's, or at least we try. It wasn't as if...
It's true. It's certainly true. Roosevelt, we talked about earlier, was nearly killed in Miami at the same time as the mayor of Chicago was actually shot dead by an anarchist who only happened to be in Miami because he wanted to bet on a dog race. And not having done well, decided he'd take a pot shot at somebody.
Yeah.
You know, people like Arthur Bremer, Sirhan Sirhan, James Earl Ray, there was, and certainly for a while before security got much, much better, there were a number of these people. Obviously, there was the case of Lincoln, there was the case of McKinley, a number of people. We had a prime minister shot in Britain in 1812. Nobody ever thought that was a conspiracy. Because this was in the days really before conspiracy theories were big. There's a reason why single gunmen tend to get through where assassination conspiracies don't, which is because what they're trying to do is much simpler.
There's many fewer things that can go wrong.
All they really need is the opportunity.
Yeah.
They don't care if they get caught. And there's only them, in a sense, they're the only working part in the conspiracy.
Yeah, the same reason Americans don't like committees is because these things get something done is do it yourself, but if you're on a committee, you're not really ever going to get it done. So similarly with assassination
right.
by committee, not
a
good
grim way. That was the mentality of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, it's like you're in a committee is never going to get this done, so I'll do it myself. So anyway, go ahead and talk about how the conspiracy theory. I think it starts through Jack Ruby. I don't know the story exactly, but go ahead and tell it.
Well, I mean, to me, so there's a kind of big demand in a way for a kind of theory which takes away the notion that America is so chaotic and so awful that you can have people like Lee Harvey Oswald. And so these conspiracy theories grow up extremely quickly. My mother, within a couple of days in Britain, said that it was a frame-up. That was her term, because she was worried that Lee Harvey Oswald was being fingered as a communist because he'd lived in Russia for a while. But in America, a guy called Mark Lane almost immediately began to say there's a whole lot of kind of suspicious circumstances here. And gradually, bit by bit, it became the Kennedy assassination industry. And you got professors, in the New York Review of Books speculating that there were two doppelganger Lee Harvey Oswalds, one kind of a shooter Lee Harvey Oswald and another a patsy Lee, kind of incredibly complicated theories. And we've now had thousands and thousands and thousands of books. And I think a whole generation has been incredibly reluctant to give up its idea of Kennedy as the victim of a conspiracy because we were brought up with it. But the fact is, if you wade through something like Vincent Bugliosi's incredible book about the Kennedy assassination, Reclaiming History, 1,400 pages, in which, amongst other things, he debunks comprehensively every single conspiracy theory that has been placed, every kind of element of it, putting what it is that we actually know and what the evidence actually was about that day, it becomes overwhelmingly clear that Lee Harvey Oswald did this on his own. He tried a few months earlier to assassinate General Walker, a John Birch Society guy, only missing by a fraction. So this guy already had previous when it came to trying to assassinate people.
Yeah.
Computer reconstructions, which we've been able to do much more, much better, much more recently, pretty clearly show that the magic bullet isn't magic, given where Kennedy was in relationship to Connolly, which was always the kind of big thing for me, and that it was easily possible in the 8.04 seconds that Lee Harvey Oswald had between firing the first shot and getting off the third shot for him to reload and take a picture on a target that was moving down his line of sight and not across it slowly, and so on. And even amongst that three shots, one of them, the first one, actually missed.
Yeah.
It was shots two and three, and the three and the third one actually being the fatal shot. Now, when you know that, there is no actual need for a complex conspiracy theory because you know enough to realize that Lee Harvey Oswald almost certainly acted on his own. You're not looking, in that sense, for another complicated conspiracy. But the desire to keep it going is so overwhelming. It's so overwhelming. I had a guy come up to me and say, he was an intelligent politician in Britain. He said these words,
Nothing you say will ever convince me that John Kennedy was not the victim of a conspiracy. In other words, there would be nothing I could say and no evidence that I could give him that would ever change his mind, because it was part now of his belief system.
Yeah, no, that's faith. That's faith. He's very, very faithful to that theory. The thing I think that, and you point this out in the book again, it's important to remember, is that there were some really strange things about the assassination, and they do kind of cry out for explanation. They're strange in the sense that they are statistically unlikely. Lee Harvey Oswald, ex-Marine, communist, moves to Russia, works, gets a Russian bride, comes back, becomes involved in anti-communist activities. They're just really strange things about the guy.
I mean, it's certainly bad luck, but by and large, you know, we do have a bad luck and coincidences and so on. I mean, essentially, somebody routed John Kennedy's slow-moving motorcade past the place where a guy who'd already a few months earlier tried to assassinate somebody else and who wanted to get his name into history was working. And that's all you need, in a sense, that's all you need to know. That was really, really, really bad luck for everybody. I mean, if you know something else as well, Kennedy had decided that he didn't want an outstanding Secret Service guy standing on the wing of his vehicle. If he'd had that guy, I mean, the Secret Service argued the toss with him, but he wanted to be seen by the public. If he'd had such a person, the chances are that Lee Harvey Oswald wouldn't have had the line of sight. I mean, what kind of bad luck is that?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the role of contingency in this is extraordinarily important. And the reason I bring up these things about Oswald is only to put it in a framework, as we did for, let's say, Hitler and the Protocols or someone like Stalin and this business with the show trials, to put it in a framework that would suggest that the people who believe these things are not completely nuts. They aren't saying that they're little green men on Mars. They're saying that there are some odd facts about this. Now, I don't believe anything they say, but it has a kind of ring of not exactly plausibility, but, you know, there are questions about it. Anything that you see that is very unusual, you're going to ask a question about it. And you're going to say, you know, how can that happen? How could something like that possibly happen? And especially if there are some weird facts attached to it, then you're going to want to know. You know, the human mind works in that way.
Absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, most conspiracy theories don't come from the uneducated. They come from the educated classes, from academics and journalists and students and so on. But though the conspiracy theory belief might be a dumb thing in the end, it's not on the whole believed by dumb people.
No, it's not.
Which is why I kind of got so interested in the business of why it is people wanted to believe this.
Yeah, there's some other ones. I want to move on now because there's one from my youth that you mentioned that I was so happy to see, and that is the one about Eric von Däniken and the Chariots of the God. I saw that when I was a little kid, and I thought, I understand everything now. I thought, this is absolutely the truth. This is the greatest. This is the smartest man ever. He's realized that aliens visited the planet, and they account for the pyramids and all this other stuff. And this is just the greatest thing ever. I had the books. You know, I was totally convinced by all this, which is great. Yeah. And the scales fell. In fact, I believed it until I read your book. No, I didn't. the scales fell from my eyes. But I don't want to talk about von Däniken too much. Anyway, that's Chariots of the God. There's another one. I can't remember whether you mentioned it or not, because I read it a little while ago. There was the business about the airliner that went down off Long Island that was supposedly shot down by Navy missiles or something.
Yeah.
Do you know this one?
I have to say, I mean, I don't recognize it immediately, but there are dozens and dozens.
Yeah, this one, a plane went down by Long Island. I was actually, at the time, I was teaching at Harvard University, and a faculty member there, a kind of very important faculty member named Elaine Scarry. No, that really is her name. Elaine Scarry. She was like totally convinced that this was true.
She wrote at least three articles for the New York Review of Books.
Exactly. Yeah. She went crazy on it, and I just was like, I'm on the faculty of this woman. I mean, I work with this woman. She's a professional like I am. What is she saying? And she lived – actually, I lived like basically across the street from her, and I knew her husband pretty well or her partner or whatever he is. And I just – I wanted to ask him, although I didn't have the guts, like, is she on drugs or something? What is she doing with this crazy conspiracy theory thing? And I never asked. But anyway, so the one I want to kind of close the interview – the one I want to talk about now in our last few minutes is, of course – the 9/11 conspiracy theorist. And in preparation for this interview, I watched, and I'll probably burn in hell for this, I watched Loose Change, 9/11, An American Coup. I watched it.
Sure.
Yeah. And I don't really know what to say about it. But anyway, why don't you tell us a little bit about the genesis of...
I bet you do know.
I do know what to say, but that's true. You're absolutely right. You're a good journalist.
Yeah,
I know exactly what to say about it. It's a load of shite. So anyway, why don't you tell us about the genesis of this 9/11 plot thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first major 9/11 conspiracy theorist was a guy called Thierry Masson, who was a French guy, who very quickly after the after 9/11 published a book which hypothesized that a missile and not a plane had gone into the Pentagon. And this was the kind of real genesis of the 9/11 truth movement. And then somebody on the internet published a 9/11 timeline, the purpose of which was to try and show that the American air defense system had been so unable to deal with the threat from the hijackers that actually it must have been deliberately stood down. Because that was the only conceivable explanation for how these planes had managed to get through. And it kind of grew from that. And then people like David Ray Griffin, who was a retiring theologian, one of America's top theologians, got involved because a woman, a fellow academic, had told him there were these websites out there that had some really interesting stuff in them, and he decided that they were true. And over the years, he's now written 8 separate books. I think he might now be coming up for a 9th since 2004 on 9/11, all of which have been getting more and more accusatory in the sense that they posit an unbelievably complicated conspiracy theory, which is now widely believed by what they call 9/11 truth movements. Now, to give you an idea of how complicated this theory is, it says no plane but a missile hit the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
So, incidentally, we have a problem here because where's Flight 77 and all the people on it? You know, where have they gone to, if that were true?
Eric von Däniken, where are you? Tell us.
No. Exactly. They're spirited away by aliens.
Yes.
Flight 93 was shot down by the American Air Force because the passengers had realized that there were no hijackers on board. And therefore, they were going to expose the plot. Yes, 2 planes did go into, probably autopiloted, into the Twin Towers, but it wasn't that brought the Twin Towers down. Separately, and for some other reason, the government had put in, had wired those buildings for demolition, which was why they fell straight down rather than falling sideways, as conspiracy theorists seem to think that they ought to have done. And the same thing happened for World Trade Center 7, which wasn't hit by a plane at all, but for other abstruse reasons, the conspirators had decided to wire that one in advance as well and bring that one down by a controlled explosion, despite the fact that if they did so, fairly obvious the fact that they did so, there would be an anomaly between the ones that were hit by the planes and the one that wasn't hit by the planes. All the phone calls from the planes that said they saw hijackers were voice morph technology. They weren't real, or were made up by people like Ted Olson, was the suggestion of Griffin afterwards, although he's reneged a bit on that. And for this incredibly complicated thing, which has autopilots, it has teams of demolition experts, it has the government deciding that for its purposes of getting a Middle Eastern war, it was insufficient for planes simply to fly into the buildings, but that it must actually blow them up as well, for reasons we've never been suggested by the conspiracy theory. And why would you do that? Why would you even need it? Wouldn't it be sufficient for the planes to go in if that's what you thought was going to go on? So this incredibly complicated theory. And now, on the basis of that, they have huge petitions, like a petition at the moment they have, which purports to be from thousands of architects and engineers saying there's something odd about it, although I've been checking through the British contributions, and actually they tend to be biodynamic psychotherapists and so on. But you'd have to kind of actually look through them properly in order to see who's done what. And these are intelligent people. That's what's in Loose Change that you saw, by and large. Exactly that, and it's held to. Now, they believe this about a government that couldn't even plant weapons of mass destruction in the Iraqi desert to be found, which you would have thought would be comparatively an absolute doddle, as we call it in Britain. I mean, kind of really, really, really easy. But look at what it poses. It poses the idea that the American government is not just bad, okay, but that it is also the best organized thing that you can possibly imagine, to a level of complexity which is absolutely remarkable. This is a government that can't stop us heading into a collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are people who say that the collapse itself was a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
But then that would tend to be somebody who believes everything is conspiracy, and,
mm-hmm.
And we're not dealing quite so much with them. So you ask yourself, how is it that really intelligent people can believe anything? So, and now let's bring in the word, because I think I've earned it after all that, could believe anything so absolutely absurd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is pretty remarkable, and it's pretty harmful, and it's not going to go away either. It's just not going to go away. I'm not quite sure what to say to these people, because I think, as you said, there really isn't anything you could do to convince them. I'm reminded of what somebody in American politics told me about a particular American administration. This is the Clinton administration that had supposedly murdered Vince Foster. You talk about that,
sure,
one, right? And he looked at me and he said, those guys couldn't organize a bake sale. How could they do that? and I think that's largely right. You know, but there's a kind of broader ramification here. You know, I spend a little bit of time on the web talking to other intelligent people, and there are people out there that really do believe that somehow the mastermind known as George Bush maneuvered us and bamboozled the American people into going to war in Iraq. And they seem to forget that there were debates about these things in the American press and in Congress. There were votes. We voted on it, you know, that it was, and I was in Washington actually working as a journalist at the time. So I remember, you know, it wasn't that we just walked into Iraq. I mean, the administration.
No, in Britain, we had a full parliamentary debate about it.
Yeah.
People could put whatever kind of view that they, or ever view they want. There was a huge kind of debate,
yeah,
including people saying we don't believe there's stuff out there, which was countered by the overwhelming belief by the intelligence services that,
yeah,
based on history and so on, that there was all that kind of argument,
yeah,
huge kind of argument about the nature of Saddam's regime.
Yeah.
It went, that argument lasted a year.
It did, yeah, it did too. You know, like I say, I was in Washington at the time, and I remember it very well. As the reports came out, and there were congressional debates, and there were inquests, and people were appearing on all the news channels, and it was being talked about, and, you know, it just wasn't as if George Bush said, okay, we're going to war in Iraq, and that's what we did. That is not what happened. And I think that, you know, this notion that things need to be simple for people is very pernicious. They forget these things, that things are simple, that in fact it's George Bush's fault, and that he was involved with the Illuminati and I don't know whomever else, and they all did it. or that, you know, Roosevelt cooked up Pearl Harbor, or that it's the Jews that are behind Germany's loss in World War
I. In a strange way, it's all under control. Somebody decided it all. The weather.
Yeah, but you just have to look at
your first point. Yeah. Somebody is in control of the weather. What a lovely kind of thought that is. Doesn't that kind of save us a lot?
But you just have to look at your own life and see that you're not in control of anything. I can't make almost anything happen. I got young kids at home. Let me tell you what. I can't make them do anything.
President Chavez, actually, you know, who's supposed at one level to be a serious guy, the president of Venezuela, which is an important player in South America now, to the Haiti earthquake, says it's the result of American nuclear tests. He has no evidence for it. But that has his explanation. It's a conspiracy. It's American tests have caused the Haitian earthquake. And you think, you know, anything in the natural world now, which you won't try and ascribe to human agency.
Yeah,
that's
bizarre. Let me ask you one final question before I ask you about your next project. I mean, I was thinking about these things and going through your book, and you know, I've learned about these things since I was very young, and everyone has been debunked one after another. Is there a moment at which we, as sort of intelligent people, have learned our lesson and realized that this boy is crying wolf and that none of these things are to be believed? Is there any hint of progress here? Are we more skeptical of these things than before?
I think people are beginning to be aware that in some cases the stakes in this are really quite high. Let me give you just two examples. The first is the argument about climate change has to be taken on the basis of what it is that we can try and have a scientific debate about. There's all kinds of people out there, particularly on the political right at the moment, they don't have a monopoly over it, who are trying to make the issue of climate change into one of conspiracy. The government is trying to conspire with it. There is absolutely no reasons why governments should try and conspire with people in order to give you unconvincing. It's very awkward for governments, global warming. It is really awkward. It means trying to persuade people in all kinds of countries to do what they don't want to do. And in democracies, that is that's a crappy assignment. In Britain. I'll give you another example, which is the growing area of, if you like, health conspiracism, which says, you know, we don't really need to vaccinate our children against measles, etc., because it's all an attempt by big pharma and the governments to get us to do things which are harmful. And this is against the scientific evidence and so on. You have people like Jim Carrey in the States kind of really going on about the, you know, as if there were evidence that MMR vaccination led to autism. In fact, there is absolutely none. All the evidence we have, indeed, insofar as we have it, tends in the other direction, and so on. But real children will die as a result of a lack of vaccination for measles, and they will die of diseases that we could easily eradicate. And I think there are groups of people, and yourself and myself, maybe a couple of other people, what I would call true skeptics, who are aware of the dangers in all this and are saying, okay, that's it, that's enough. I mean, it's one thing to have a nutty theory of whether spacemen created Earth. It's quite another to go around getting people to believe that vaccination is not good for you, and as a result ruining the health of children you've never met.
From your lips to God's ears, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, all professional historians stand with you. I don't think we probably pay enough attention to this stuff because we're too busy writing monographs that only a few people will read. But, you know, really the bulwark against this kind of stuff, if we can use that word, is serious-minded journalism and history, is a group of people who believe in professional standards and will try to find the truth and will not do what I think everybody in journalism knows and people who write books know as well, and that is that if you want to be listened to, if you want to be heard, if you want to get a large audience in the modern world, you just have to say something absolutely outrageous. Yeah. And, you know, journalism is headed in that direction really hard, I'm sorry to say, not so much history. But I know that, you know, as I say, I used to work in journalism, and the desire to print things that are so-called counterintuitive – this is the buzzword they use. I want counterintuitive stuff, the editor would say. Well, that means outrageous stuff. You know, just outrageous.
In other words, rubbish.
Yeah, good bullshit.
Exactly. You're exactly right. But I think that there is a backlash to that. I think there's a backlash, as I said, in the skeptics movement. We have a great guy called Ben Goldacre in Britain who's written a book called Bad Science.
I know this book.
Aspect of this. That book's done incredibly well in Britain.
Good.
And it just shows that there is we have a group called Skeptics in the Pub. And they meet in pubs, and they meet in London and Oxford and Liverpool and now in a number of other places. And there's the James Randi Foundation and so on over here in the States. And, you know, I think we're beginning to get our act together now.
That's good. Well, no, I'm really glad to hear that. And again, thank you very much for your work. Let me close the interview. We've taken up a lot of your time, obviously. I'm sorry about that. I could talk about this stuff all day long with you. What is and I know you've done a million of these interviews, so I really appreciate you being on the show. What is your next project? What are you working on now?
Yeah, I'm taking up the continuum of why people believe what they did. I'm going to kind of project it backwards into my own parents' politics and into the period of British communism, which is always a kind of minority thing, which was in the 50s and 60s, to try and work out why they believed what they did and what kind of life they led. And I think it's really about the nature of ideology and of how belief leads to both good and bad consequences, really. It's a difficult assignment, and it's quite a personal one. So I'll see how I go with it.
Well, it sounds like a very rewarding project, and I wish you luck on it. And when you're done, you'll have to be on the show again. Okay. All right. Well, let me tell our listeners that we're talking to David Aaronovitch, and we've been discussing his book, Voodoo Histories, which I highly recommend to you. David, thanks very much for being on the show.
It's been great.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with David Aaronovitch about his new book, Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.